Logan Verrett was going to throw a pitch, but he had to point to Darnold because a ball had dropped out of Bob Davidson's sack. Bag and dropped down on the ground.
I've never seen a ball fall out of the sack before.
2-1 to Altair.
There are times when I regret that this show is live.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Is there a way that we can somehow swap the Mets announcers for the Raw announcers on Mondays? Just kind of swap them out? Can we find a way to do that? Is that even possible? Because I think Raw would be a lot more tolerable if we had Gary Cohen, Keith Hernandez, and Ron Darling. If we have to have a three-man announce booth, I would gladly take them over what we have now. This is episode 403 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 4, 2015. I am the Solid Monster. Thank you very much for tuning into the podcast, however you are doing so. Some of you subscribe through iTunes, some of you listening through Stitcher, some of you directly through the Podbean app, our free Android app. Lots of different ways to listen to this podcast each and every week as we head towards our 8-year anniversary coming up about a month from now. I finally had the chance to see the Resurrection of Jake the Snake movie, this documentary that DDP and Steve Yu, I believe is the name of the director, they've been working on this for quite some time. They had a screening of the film in Times Square on Friday night, and the documentary really starts from the point that DDP met with Jake at Jake's worst. I mean, when Jake was up to about 300 pounds, he could barely move. All the way to him moving in with Dallas and starting, you know, the DDP yoga routine, dropping all the weight, falling off the wagon, getting back on the wagon, bringing Scott Hall into the house, right on through Jake and Scott being inducted into the Hall of Fame. It really is. I mean, the story is more about addiction, or as much about addiction, I think, as it is a story of redemption that they're trying to tell. And until Jake reveals in the movie that Triple H called him up on the phone to tell him that he was going into the Hall of Fame, a big theme throughout the movie was Jake wanting to be in that Royal Rumble match in 2014, which is the first Rumble match the fans hijacked. That was the one that Daniel Bryan wasn't in. I mean, this guy badly wanted to be in that Royal Rumble match. He made it a goal. It was a personal goal of his. I will make it to the Rumble. And clips from different people in the movie, like, you know, big names, Jericho and Austin and Edge. And they even have clips with Goldust as himself, as Dustin Runnels, and this was from a couple of years ago. And even in the movie, Dustin's like, you know, Jake, you are going to make it to the Royal Rumble. Like, this Rumble thing was a big deal to him. And it really was, it really jumps out at you how big a mistake that was to not have him in there. You know, I wrote a whole article months before that I published on JBL's old website, The Layfield Report, pitching the idea of, I think I titled it, you know, a Royal Rumble redemption for Jake the Snake. This was actually in May of 2013 that I wrote that column, okay, over 6 months before the Rumble. And the idea is that they would announce Jake for the match a few months in advance. He would be the first person formally announced for the Royal Rumble. And then you would film segments with him maybe a couple of times each month. You know, you wouldn't do it every week. Segments that, having now watched the film, are actually pretty similar to what they did in the movie. So maybe that's why they didn't do it on TV. You know, maybe TDP was making this movie. Maybe he didn't want it. I don't know. But just filming him, you know, training, doing the yoga, rehabbing, because Jake had a few injuries. He needed shoulder surgery, although I think he was already recovered from that by the time the Rumble rolled around. But just showing him, again, training and rehabbing and going through a bunch of different emotions, all so that he can make this big, triumphant return in that Rumble match. You know, one last pop, one last DDT. It's all he had to do. He could have done it to Heath Slater. I think at the time, Heath Slater, whatever gimmick it was that he was doing, maybe he was still doing, you know, the legend stuff, although I think that was earlier on. Yeah, but Heath Slater would have been the perfect person in the Rumble match, eat the DDT, let Jake eliminate one guy, even if it is just Heath Slater. It would have been a nice moment, and they didn't do it. And, you know, for a company that says, oh, we love to tell stories, we're storytellers, they really missed the boat, I think, on a great one here. And to be able to put that in the movie would have made the movie even better. they actually have a screenshot of my article in the movie. You know, the headline, the byline, the whole thing, in a scene where DDP and Jake are sitting at DDP's laptop, and he's telling Jake, "Hey, what a great story! What a great article this is! And you can do this. You'll be in the Rumble." You know, that was a thrill for me to see that up on the screen, and just how they were using it as motivation for Jake. I got a kick out of that. I wasn't expecting that. It's really too bad they didn't run with the idea. And hell, I mean, look, you got 30 spots to fill in the Rumble. I went back to see who was actually in the Rumble match that year. Kevin Nash was in there. You know, JBL got up from the announce booth, and he was eliminated almost immediately. They had freaking El Torito in the goddamn thing, but they couldn't find a spot for Jake the Snake. But it does end on a happy note, the movie. I mean, there's high moments, there's low moments. This is not Beyond the Mat. This will not depress the hell out of you the way that movie did. It's in very limited release right now. I would imagine it's going to maybe hit Netflix, or it'll end up as a digital download soon enough. Lots of WWE footage in the movie, although apparently they went to WWE for permission to use their footage, and WWE said no, which shocked me when I heard that after the fact. They ended up using it anyway, I guess, because their lawyer found some kind of loophole, fair use, or whatever, that allowed them to use the footage without being sued, so they used it. I just assumed that WWE gave them the okay, but apparently not. But I think the movie is absolutely worth checking out, whether you're a Jake the Snake fan or not. You watch this movie, and the other thing that you realize is DDP deserves a Hall of Fame induction just for the work that he has done with Jake and Scott Hall alone. Because had it not been for him intervening when he did, I don't think it's a stretch to say that Jake and or Scott may not be around right now. Especially Scott. I mean, Scott was really in bad shape. They have the footage in there, which is up, on YouTube. I mean, I think a lot of people have seen this already. When DDP called Scott Hall, I guess X-Pac tipped him off and said, "Hey, listen, Scott's in real rough shape. Maybe you can reach out to him." And there's the scene that they filmed of DDP. He's got Scott on speakerphone. Him and Jake are sitting there. And Scott, he's barely coherent. He's telling them how he's drank nothing but vodka for breakfast. And even Waltman had told DDP, "Hey, listen, he's talking about offing himself. This is really bad." Who the hell knows where either one of these guys would be right now were it not for DDP stepping in and saying, "Hey, listen, you know, you got to get your shit together." And you look at them now, and it's pretty amazing. There's even somebody in the movie, I think, who makes the comment that if you had to make a wrestler death pool, these two guys would have been at the top of your list. And you see them now, they're in the Hall of Fame, and they're out, and they're making appearances, and they look better, they've lost all that weight, and they've got this new lease on life, and so it's just a really great story, and like I said, I highly recommend it if you can find a screening somewhere, or just wait for the download. I'm sure it'll be available soon enough. We have the 8-year anniversary coming up for the Sound Off next month. I've mentioned this the last few weeks, coming up on November 8th. And in celebration, I have been doing a countdown of 8 of my favorite WWE matches of all time in no particular order. Match number 1 was the 1992 Royal Rumble match. Match number 2 was Steve Austin against Dude Love from Over the Edge, 1998. And thanks to Luis, by the way, he was the one who chimed in after the show last week and said it was MIT that offered that college course on wrestling where they showed that match. Luis was in that class. He said Jim Ross made an appearance as a guest speaker. Mick Foley made an appearance as a guest speaker. I looked it up. It was Comparative Media Studies, American Professional Wrestling. That was the name of the class. It was given in 2007. The syllabus is still online if you search around for it. It's up on the MIT site. Great match. Anyway, I'll reveal match number 3 after the mailbag later in the show. A lot of you went and watched that Over the Edge match after I talked about it last week, and you really enjoyed it. I thought that was pretty cool. A lot of people had never seen it before or hadn't seen it since it originally aired in 98. And a lot of you were saying how much you enjoyed that match. And that's part of what I wanted to do with this list, why I went out of my way to try to pick matches that you can find on the network, or YouTube or whatever. And like I said before, all but one of the matches that I've picked for this countdown, you can find on the network if you have a subscription. The one match that is not on the network, which I'll get to in a few weeks, I may actually save that for the last show on the 8th. You can't find that on the network right now, or on YouTube. I think you can only find it in one place on Dailymotion, and we'll get to that in a few weeks. But First, let me just mention this before we move on here, before I forget. Audible. Keep supporting Audible. They've been a great sponsor for us. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster is our custom URL. So if you are thinking about signing up for a trial, you've heard of Audible, you want to try this whole audiobook thing, you don't know what to expect, you can try it out free for 30 days. They will not bill you. And if you do not like it, you can cancel at any point in those 30 days. You will not be charged. You get to keep one free audiobook of your choosing. So no matter what, once you sign up, if you've never signed up before, you can pick one audiobook. And they've got a bunch of wrestling books, including the new Daniel Bryan book that just came out a couple of months ago. Shawn Michaels' book is up there. His most recent one, Chris Jericho's most recent book is up there. Lex Luger's book, Hulk Hogan's book, Dusty Rhodes. His book is up there as well. But it doesn't have to be a wrestling book. As long as there's an Audible version for it, and most books do have an Audible version, you can get it for free. And if you do that, use our link, because you're helping the podcast out when you do so. And if you've already done this, by the way, spread the link around. You know, send it to a friend or a family member, your mom, whatever, whoever might be into audiobooks, and give them the URL. audibletrial.com/Solomonster is the link to use for that. And if you like what you hear each week, you can make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. $30 or more will get you a nickname and a brief shout-out for your own podcast or YouTube channel. Just make sure you include that information when you send in the donation. Thank you this week to Luis Hercules Hernandez, Deadpool James Herrera, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Killshot Keith Hart, Slice and Dice Philip Kruger, James Hollywood Henderson, Ben Ironclaw Crawford, Kevin the Promise Thomas, Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson, Tarkin Danger Zone Davis, Samuel the Slayer Cipperoni, David Sold Out Solis, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra, Chaos Kadeem Simmons, Jason Core Strength Quarter, R.I.P. Flippa, William H. Bullard IV, and John Pipelayer Pog, still one of my favorite nicknames. I'm very proud of that one. He runs the Reckless Intent channel on YouTube, so to find it, go to the search bar and type in WWE 2K15 Extreme Moments Finale, and it is the third video down. That's the easiest way to click onto the channel, because there's a couple of different channels called Reckless Intent, obviously, but that's the way to find John's channel, and you can check that out. So thank you to everybody who made a donation. Again, you can do so at any time on the right-hand side of the page on thesolomonster.com. And one last plug real quick, not for me, but for our friend Joey Numbers from Wrestling Soup. He's going to be on the Race Wars podcast this Wednesday, October 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern. So if you're not watching TakeOver, even if you are watching TakeOver, just do both. The show airs on Opie Radio on Sirius XM. I think it's XM Channel 103 or Sirius Channel 206. I hope I'm getting that right. So show some support for Joey Numbers this Wednesday. Last night, WWE had its Live from Madison Square Garden special that aired on the network, the first time that they have taken a house show, unless you count the Japan show. But this was the first domestic house show. How about that? We'll use that word. That they have aired on the network. And when it was over, you know, my impression was kind of just like, meh. Yeah, it was what it was. I was kind of gauging some of your reaction online, people that were tweeting me, and then other people's reactions online as well. I mean, the consensus that I saw seems to be that people just enjoyed it for what it was, but they were maybe disappointed in some of the finishes, and especially the tag team title match, and Brock and Big Show was too short, and Kane interfering in the main event. But you gotta remember, it was a house show. You know, I know, yes, it aired on the network. They turned it into a TV special, but it was still just a house show. And many, many moons ago here on this podcast, in the early days of the network, I talked at length about how they should air house shows, or at least parts of house shows, even if it's just cut-ins. You have Renee Young, or you have, what's that other guy, Tom Phillips, you know, at a house show somewhere in like a major market, and you cut in and you air matches if you don't want to air the whole show. But you can air the whole show from Madison Square Garden. You can air the whole show from the arena over there in Chicago or from L.A. They should do more of that. You know, people aren't going to necessarily be buying the network just to see house shows, but it's one of those things that they can do to make the network a little bit more must-see. If they know that there's going to be live events, current live events that are airing on the network that they can't see anywhere else unless they buy a ticket, there are some people who I think may just sign up for the network, or at least the people who are signed up, maybe who don't watch a whole lot of stuff, maybe they'll be more engaged. You know, whatever the case may be. It's the kind of stuff that they should be doing more of. And they obviously felt the same way, because now we're starting to finally, after all this time, see them do that. But from day one, when I first was talking about this idea, it wasn't as though I had any expectation that, well, if they start airing house shows on the network, we're going to see title changes and we're going to see developments in major angles. They got 3 hours of television on Monday night for that. They don't need to advance any kind of storyline on a house show. Yeah, you can throw people a bone and maybe have a, you know, like an undercard title change every now and then. I mean, I will say, you know, one thing that I was disappointed they didn't do, and it became a moot point the minute that Sting got injured in that match at Night of Champions, but I would have loved to have seen them put the title on Sting just for a few weeks. They didn't even have to let him hold it until Hell in a Cell. If they wanted to do this Kane feud so badly, they could have just had Kane help Sting win instead of coming out after the match. And you give Sting a couple of weeks to just hold on to the title. He gets a token title reign, so when he goes into the Hall of Fame, they can call him a WWE champion instead of a WCW champion. And at the Madison Square Garden show, besides Brock Lesnar wrestling, what a cool thing it would be for the fans just in the building to get to see Sting make his very first appearance ever inside Madison Square Garden, and it's a title defense. And Sting drops the title to Rollins in the main event. Rollins actually wins the championship back on a house show, which wouldn't be the first time that's happened, at Madison Square Garden. And then from there, you got a few weeks to promote Hell in a Cell. You just proceed as usual with your Kane-Seth Rollins nonsense that they've got going on TV. So, yeah, they could have done a title change to make it a little more special, but it's not like when the show was over, I was disappointed. It was a house show. I don't really see a need for people to get too bent out of shape about it. Brock and Big Show is exactly what I thought it would be. I didn't see that match going very long at all. I still think it was a complete waste. I would have preferred to see Lesnar in there with somebody he's never wrestled before. They felt differently. It pisses me off even more to think that this is what Cesaro was sacrificed for. But it is what it is. So yeah, I would have had a different opponent for Brock. But the match was fine. Yeah, he botched that first F5, but I thought he rebounded okay. He gave him another suplex, and then he picked him up, dropped him, left, came back. Gave him another F5, and a belly-to-belly, too. That was pretty impressive. So it was exactly what I thought it would be. You know, the main event was John Cena and Seth Rollins in a cage. I thought they had a pretty damn good match, as far as cage matches go. And then Kane comes at it. I mean, it's a little goofy to see somebody like Seth Rollins, who, you know, he moves around pretty quick, and all of a sudden he's up there on top of the cage. It's like he forgot how to climb down, you know, because he's waiting for Kane to come down to the ring. I thought that was a little clumsy, but you know, Kane comes out, he's standing there, and Seth has a decision to make. Do I climb down or do I go back in? And then he took that big bump off the top of the cage. I thought he broke his leg on the way down, the way he landed. Thankfully, he didn't. Basically, attempted a frog splash from the very top of the cage, and Cena moved and gave him the AA and pinned him, and that was it. And so Cena retains the U.S. title. Kane then locked himself inside the cage with Seth. He gave him a choke slam, gave him a tombstone. And much the same way he did on Raw last Monday, Kane stood tall to end the show with the WWE Championship. We had the New Day and the Dudley Boys. Dudley Boys won by DQ. They did the same finish that they had done on TV the other day, where Xavier Woods ran in for the DQ after the 3D. He saved the titles, and then they put Xavier through a table afterwards for the nice little send-off moment, I guess, for the Dudleys in front of their hometown fans. Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho for the Intercontinental title. You know, I will say this. If I was disappointed by anything on the show, it was this match. It was not a bad match, but I was expecting more. Especially because these guys have been doing the house show loop for a while now. They've even had some cage matches. I've read report after report. Oh, these great matches between Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho. I thought it was good. It really wasn't anything overly special. I didn't think. It was cool to see Lance Storm and Cyrus, you know, Don Callis there at ringside. They were the guests. It was Jericho's 25th anniversary in the business, so he invited them. We had, I'm going backwards here, in reverse order, by the way. I guess the other thing that also just made me shake my head was they actually had Team PCB. And I'm going to get into this when I get to the Raw review, because this pissed me off on Monday night, too. But they had Team PCB together. Apparently, you know, Paige doesn't like her partners very much. And her partners don't like Paige, but somehow, they're still a team. So they lost to Team Bella when Charlotte and Becky hopped off the apron when Paige went for a tag, giving her a taste of her own medicine from what happened on Raw the previous week, although the fans booed when they jumped off the apron, because Paige is not a babyface anymore. That's not how she's been positioned, but the fans still cheer for her. So they were not happy when Charlotte and Becky jumped off the apron. That was not the reaction I think they were going for. We had Neville beating Stardust, and then the show actually opened with Randy Orton and Dolph Ziggler against Sheamus and Rusev. Now, the original card had a Randy Orton versus Sheamus singles match. I wanted to hang myself. So I was at least somewhat pleased that they changed it. It wasn't just a straight-up singles match. I still had to sit through Randy Orton and Sheamus for a few minutes. But this was actually probably one of the better matches on the show in terms of crowd heat, because they opened with it. And that was it. It was a house show. There's really nothing to complain about. Hopefully they do more of these on the network in the future. But it was just, again, don't get too bent out of shape about a house show. There is actually a bit of John Cena news. I wanted to mention this too. Cena is apparently taking time off for what they're calling personal reasons. So we don't exactly know why. And, you know, they're personal. So it's really none of our business. I don't read too much into that. I think whatever it is, it sounds like it was planned. This is not something that just came up. So hopefully everything's cool with his family. I know he had a brother, I think, who had cancer. I don't know if he still does or not, but hopefully everything is cool with his family and it's nothing serious. It sounds like it may have just been some planned time off that he had put in for a while back, which makes even less sense to me than why they had Cena beat Rollins to win back the U.S. title if they knew he was going to be taking time off. That part I don't get. But he is off the November European tour and probably will not be back, it sounds like, until around Christmas time. I know they're going to be back at the Garden for a house show. They have their annual post-Christmas Madison Square Garden house show. I think Cena is expected back around then, so it's not as though it's open-ended here and John Cena is going to be gone for months and months. He really should be. He'll probably be away for about 6 weeks or so. Yeah, Cena taking time off may not be good for ratings. I think it's good for the health of that company overall, though, and for his health, too. Maybe it'll force them to push one or two new guys higher up on the card. Maybe. I know I'm probably completely foolish thinking that. And he's not going to be gone for long enough, I think, to really establish somebody new on top. But they could at least try. I don't even care at this point if it's Cesaro. I've all but given up on that. It's just not going to happen. I accept it. There's nothing we can do about it. You can bring Cesaro section size to every fucking show. It's not going to make a difference. Just anybody. Anybody. Cesaro, Ambrose, somebody. They can try to elevate them to a level above where they have been stagnating at. That's the one big benefit you get when somebody like John Cena steps away. So maybe we can actually get something positive out of that. Some other news broke this week. SummerSlam is going to be back in New York City next year and 2017. I guess they did so well with their three straight sellouts at the Barclays Center. They're going to do it again. So it's going to be NXT, SummerSlam, and Raw the next night all in the same building. This is going to be an annual thing now, at least for the next 2 years. So that's pretty cool for those of us who live here on the East Coast. And Hornswoggle. Yes, Hornswoggle was suspended for 30 days for violating the wellness policy. They posted a note on their website. In accordance with its talent wellness program, WWE has suspended Dylan Postal, a.k.a. Hornswoggle, for 30 days, effective immediately, for his first violation of the policy. It had been, I hadn't even realized this until I read it this week, it was over 2 years since they had last announced a wellness suspension. And we finally get another, and it's Hornswoggle. I can't even remember the last time Hornswoggle was on TV. But of all people, it's Hornswoggle, which obviously means the rest of the roster is totally 100% clean. And if you believe that, I've got a company down in Nashville I can sell you. Real cheap, too. About $100. Which actually, I should bring that up now. Poor TNA. You saw the photo, I'm sure, online of Finn Balor outside their offices in Nashville giving him the crotch chop. NXT was on the road in Nashville this weekend. I'd like to think it was the demon that did that. You know, regular Finn Balor is too nice to do something like that. He needs to be in full body paint and headdress getup when he does things like this. So if he gets in trouble, he can just blame it on the demon. Like, next week we get a photo of him up in Baltimore dropping his pants and mooning the Ring of Honor office. You know, wasn't Finn. It was that pesky demon. I guess they're kind of already doing that, though, with this Demon Kane storyline. I could see a Demon Kane versus Demon Balor match at next year's WrestleMania. I'm not saying I want it. I'm just saying I could see that. The one thing I will say, though, crotch chop, really? We're still doing that in 2015. That's the best he could come up with. I think everybody looked kind of sad in this situation. Let's talk about Raw. Monday Night Raw was live from Buffalo, New York, this past week. Record low ratings for the second straight week, down slightly from that awful number the week before. And wouldn't you know, suddenly Brock Lesnar has been added to the show this Monday. So when desperate, you bring back the Beast to stand behind Paul Heyman and bounce up and down, which is probably all Brock Lesnar is going to do on this show. I'm happy Brock is there. I'd like to see him more often. I think the show needs it. But all they're doing is putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. You know, they've got a much, much bigger problem that bringing back a big name or bringing back a legend. Like, in a few weeks, they're going to have Stone Cold and Shawn Michaels and Ric Flair. And, you know, it's nice to bring back names like that every now and then. But you can bring back every fucking name in the world. It's not going to fix the problem that they have. And unless they realize, hey, this is the problem and this is how we fix it, nothing's ever going to change. Cesaro was MIA from this show. Instead, he was on Superstars this week, wrestling Heath Slater. Right where he belongs, I guess. Right, Vince? Someone pointed out to me that this Monday, tomorrow, marks the 18-year anniversary of Kane's debut, which also marks the 18-year anniversary of what is still the greatest Hell in a Cell match the company's ever had. And the first one that they ever had between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. 18 years later, Kane is challenging for the WWE title at their next pay-per-view. So the more things change, the more they stay the same. The storyline throughout this show here was someone had emailed Human Resources with an anonymous complaint about corporate Kane. Here's a hint, it was me. I didn't want anybody to know, but I'm revealing it now. So they had an actress playing the head of HR, which Stephanie made sure to explain meant human resources for all of us dumb shits watching on TV. A show, mind you, that has a median viewer age of around 40. Contrary to all those people who think it's mostly kids, Solid Monster, you prick. They have to announce what HR means. Little kids won't know what it means. Fuck the kids. 40 fucking year olds are watching this show. By far. More than any children's demographic. You got fucking 40-year-olds watching this show. They don't have to spell out every little fucking thing. So Ashley was this woman's name. She was going to monitor Kane throughout the entire show and issue her report later on. They wanted you to think that Seth Rollins was the one who emailed the complaint. I'm amazed that they thought a corporate Kane performance evaluation was the answer to their ratings problems. Shockingly, it didn't work. I know. I'm as surprised as you are. In another segment later on, Kane presented Seth with a gift box. And inside was the severed head from the Rollins statue that Sting had trashed weeks ago. Kane said he went to the landfill in Baltimore, where the show belonged, to dig up the head. I thought Kane was actually pretty entertaining in this segment. See, that's the thing. I don't hate the Kane character. He's more often than not, especially this corporate Kane stuff, he's actually pretty funny. It's not even that I absolutely hate the Kane character. It's not really that. It's that I don't like the idea that this is your championship feud. And I don't like the idea that everything has to be built around this guy and this character. It's not working. You know what I mean? And it's been going on now for so long. You know what I find offensive? The fact that they have been building this story with Rollins and Kane, right? The animosity between them, all that fake enthusiasm that Kane would have because he just wanted to please Triple H and Stephanie, so he put up with all of Seth's shit for month after month after month, and then he got hurt with the injury angle. He comes back. If you really stop and think about it, it's a fairly well-constructed, well-thought-out storyline, long-term storyline that actually had some long-term thought put into it that's been playing out now for a good part of the year since WrestleMania. But it's fucking Kane and Seth Rollins. Why can't they put that kind of effort into a story involving two people that you and I actually give a shit about? Why can't they put that kind of long-term thought and planning into something with people that matter? Nobody cares about Kane and Seth Rollins. Who gives a shit? Why can't you put that kind of long-term thought into something that people will actually pay to see? It's just, it's frustrating to me. It's like everybody else, they don't matter. We'll book week to week, even Steven, all that bullshit. But hey, Kane and Seth Rollins, I got a great story that's going to play out over the next 6 months. Oh, great. Can't wait to see that. It's like they clearly have the ability to book long-term. And they just choose not to do it. And when they do, it's just, I don't get it. I just don't understand it. And now you see the ratings are where they are. Apparently house show attendance is down. Business overall right now, very much down for WWE. And it goes beyond the fact, oh, it's the fall season, they're always down. Yeah, there is something to be said for that. They are all generally down. September, October, it's not their strongest period of the year. But this is even far beyond that. Later in the show, Ashley issued her findings and found that Kane was of sound mind to be the director of operations, and if anybody was a problem here, it was Seth, who she found to be paranoid and unprofessional. Rollins attacked corporate Kane, gave him a pedigree, beat the shit out of him with about 25 chair shots, and then he pilmanized Kane's previously injured ankle. Kane did a stretcher job out of the arena, and this was played up like a major injury angle. We saw the ambulance with Kane inside start to pull away, and all of a sudden, the ambulance came to a stop. And this was a scene right out of the opening to Halloween 4, for all of you horror fans out there who get the obscure reference. The ambulance filled with smoke and a red light, not unlike many a college dorm room. Demon Kane then emerged from the ambulance having, I guess, massacred everybody inside. We never did find out what happened to them. He was limping on his broken ankle. Then he stopped, and he stomped on the ground. And when he did, you heard them snapping a stick of celery off screen for the sound effect of him snapping the ankle back in place so that he could walk. Kane came to the ring. He chokeslammed Rollins. He tried for a tombstone. Rollins escaped, and Kane stood there laughing and holding up the WWE Championship belt. 18 years later. 18 years. It's a long time. John Cena resumed his U.S. title open challenge, which was accepted by Xavier Woods. Cena had him beat when New Day ran in for the DQ. The Dudleys ran down. You can pretty much figure out what happened at this point. Six-man tag team match with Kofi pinning Devon after Trouble in Paradise to build to their match at MSG. I thought this was kind of a waste of the open challenge gimmick, which I've enjoyed for most of the year, and I just thought there was, you know, no real effort put into it here. The last time we had a Miz TV segment on Raw with the Divas, it was a disaster. They tried it again on this show. It was not a disaster, I will say that. It was Charlotte and Becky. Becky threw Miz's microphone out of the ring, which made the segment five times better. And Charlotte called on Paige to come on down. She was very angry, very upset. She wanted Paige's ass. So instead, she got the Bellas and Alicia Fox. Nikki claimed that she started the Divas Revolution, which, as I said last week, is kind of true. She was such a bad champion, she started a revolution to overthrow her, like any good dictator. Paige came out to a nice pop from the crowd. She again made a crack about the Bellas sleeping their way to the top. And I again laughed at the idea that sleeping with Daniel Bryan might somehow help Brie Bella politically. You know, based on how the guy was booked for much of his run in the company and how much they had to, you know, put the title on him kicking and screaming last year, if anything, I would think Vince McMahon would have less respect for Brie Bella, knowing that they're together. Paige also referred to Cena and Bryan without naming them as their boyfriends, which I'm sure made Daniel Bryan very sad to learn that he apparently never really did marry Brie Bella last year. So a brawl broke out. Team PCB working together against the Bellas. This was stupid. This is what I was talking about when I was doing the MSG review earlier, and we saw it again last night, but to go back to Raw this week, this past week, this was even dumber. So they go to commercial break. They come back, and for the second time on this show, we have an unscheduled six-person tag, which is another thing killing the show, by the way. This epidemic, this epidemic number of six-person tag team matches. Six-mans are okay, but not when you do them multiple times, week after week after... It's like every week, every main event, every week, it's a tag team match. They mean nothing. They just stick groups of people in matches every week, and people don't care. But that's not even what pissed me off about this. What pissed me off is that they come back from break, and there's Paige, teaming with Charlotte and Becky like they're the best of friends. Not even a hint of animosity between them. Not a hint that Paige would rather be anywhere but where she is, on the apron, teaming with these two women. Now, the story they wanted to tell was later in the match, Paige is accidentally bumped off the apron by Charlotte. She then walks out on her team. And Natty comes out, and she's asking Paige, what are you doing? And Natty runs down to the ring to take her spot. But as Natty climbs up on the apron, Paige rushes back down and trips her off the apron, which distracts Charlotte, and Nikki pins her with the rack attack. So there's that even Steven booking again, by the way. I know what they were trying to do here. They could have done it a different way. Paige just teaming with those two again, and they did it again last night. After everything that she has said about them, it's not even just the fact that Paige would be willing to team with them, that they would be willing to accept her and trust her as their partner. None of this makes any sense. So I think this is stupid. And I thought they had finally turned to Paige, no pun intended, in this whole Divas Revolution crap. You know, Paige cut that promo and they were finally going to break her away from PCB and stop all this team nonsense. We don't even see Sasha Banks on TV. Hopefully they're just holding her out until after the Iron Man match at TakeOver, and then we'll start to see her more often once she's permanently on Raw and she's not doing NXT anymore. I hope that's the only reason why they're holding her out. She's not getting any TV time on Raw at all. But this was just dumb. This was a step back, I think, from what they did a few weeks ago. Paul Heyman came out for his weakest promo in a long time. He was there to hype up the Lesnar-Big Show match at MSG. There's only so much you can do. I mean, people just, they did not buy into the match. They didn't buy into the fact that the Big Show even had a prayer against this guy. It was not a match that people wanted to see. He did the best he could. Big Show came out, he babbled on for a bit, which led to Heyman storming off as though he actually thought Big Show might beat Lesnar. And again, nobody bought it for a second, so this just didn't work. The main event, especially the end of the main event, or the post-match, probably the best thing on the entire, not even probably, it was the best thing on the entire show. Roman Reigns and Bray Wyatt had a match. The crowd was dead for a good part of it. By the end, they picked up, they did a double count-out finish, but what followed after that, they were brawling all over the building. They brawled into the crowd, they brawled back out of the crowd. They had this great spot at the very end where Bray Wyatt is standing on top of the announce desk and he's got his arms out and he's posing, and then Roman Reigns, who was in the crowd and had been beaten down, suddenly pops out from out of nowhere and spears Roman, he spears himself. Now, he speared Bray Wyatt off the table. They collapsed through the table in a heap. It was actually really well done. It was actually a great way to go off the air, and it made me want to see these two guys get in the Hell in a Cell, which is what they're doing. I was not a fan of doing more than one Hell in a Cell match on this next pay-per-view, but if you think about it, for Roman and Bray, if this is the blow-off, and if this isn't, then this is fucking stupid. But if this is the climax and the big blow-off of their feud, then it belongs in Hell in a Cell. It's been going on for long enough. It is a match deserving of being inside the Cell, so I don't have any problem with that, provided it is the blow-off. On October 26th, or whatever that day is after the pay-per-view, if they're still fucking wrestling, then you can say, Sala Monster, you were stupid. I give you permission to say that. But I enjoyed this. I thought this was good. And actually, I didn't realize this, but one of the cool spots here was when they were brawling in the crowd, at one point, Bray grabbed a stagehand, a planted stagehand, and literally flung him like he was taking out the trash. Just hurled this guy at Roman Reigns. And it turns out that guy was Tony Nese, who I think spent some time in TNA, but more recently I've seen him. He's been working some Five Borough Wrestling shows here in Brooklyn. He's still working indie shots, so I didn't know it was Tony as I was watching this poor guy fly through the air. But yep, that's who it was. So that was Raw from this past week. Were it not for that ending, oof, this would not have been good.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
The
NXT opened with a quarterfinal match in the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic, Samoa Joe and Finn Balor against Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy. Finn Balor's new Titantron now has the Balor Club logo as a playoff of the Bullet Club. I like this. I like this match. You know, it's four guys you would not normally see wrestling each other. Four baby faces, basically going toe-to-toe. It wasn't long enough, though. I thought the match was too short. Enzo busted out an impressive jumping DDT out of the corner on Finn at one point. Big Kaz caught Joe coming off the ropes with the old Abyss Black Hole Slam. Rocket launcher by Kaz and Enzo on Joe. Joe powered out, though. He delivered a muscle buster to Enzo, followed by the coup de grace by Balor for the win. So they advance. And the announcers kind of telegraphed a Balor-Joe win in the tournament later on. They're like, oh, those are your two winners right there. And I admit that probably means they're not winning. But I am still sticking with them as my pick. I'm going to do takeover predictions, by the way, at the end here. So we'll get to that in a little bit. We'll go through the whole card. I also want to talk about this. You know, Kaz and Enzo are out there. Carmella's with them. Carmella was hurt at a house show, NXT house show in Nashville on Friday night in a match with Eva Marie. I'm not sure of all the details. It sounds like it may have been from a stiff kick to the head. She may have been knocked loopy. I don't know if she's concussed. I had one report that I read that said she may have suffered a stinger. Whatever it was, she got hurt. She was shaken up. She was crying. The doctors were in the ring. They had to help her out. People who were there at ringside emailed me and said she had this very glassy look in her eye, like she wasn't all there. So it's unfortunate. And I see people jumping down Eva Marie's throat, you know, and they're ripping her a new one. Of course, she's green, and what's she doing? She's hurting people now. First of all, we don't have all the facts. It could very easily have been a mistake that Carmella made, because when Carmella is in the ring with Eva Marie, and I said this going into their match at TakeOver in Brooklyn, it's like the blind leading the blind. Carmella, I love her, but she's really not that good. And Eva Marie is even worse. So you have two women who may not have any fucking clue what they're doing sometimes in the ring, and shit's bound to happen. So, you know, let's not pretend that Carmella here is a modern-day Trish Stratus here, who's the most experienced woman on the roster. She's not. And I haven't really heard anything that would be definitive that it was Eva Marie's fault. Maybe she took a bump wrong. Maybe she was in the wrong spot. We don't know. Could I believe that Eva Marie fucked up and hurt this woman? Yeah, absolutely. But I kind of feel bad for her, because everybody's jumping on her. We don't even have all the facts yet. So I would say, let's just not be so quick to blame Eva. We could blame Eva for a lot of things. She's not very good. But, you know, reaming this woman because she injured somebody else without knowing if that's actually what happened, you know, that's a little extreme. So I'm not gonna go too hard on her yet. But I do feel sorry for Carmella having to work all these matches with Eva Marie, because bad shit is bound to happen. Whoever's fault it is. And she's working matches with this woman seemingly every week. So I feel bad for Carmella. Hopefully she's okay. Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa were back on the show. Very disappointed. They were bounced from the Dusty Classic. They were talking about how disappointed they were. Ciampa became a modern-day Rick Rude here, appearing on two different wrestling shows in one night, here on NXT and also on Impact, which was taped months ago. Of course, the combined audience for Rick Rude's appearances on Raw and Nitro in 1997 were probably 5 million people. Ciampa did not get anywhere close to that many people watching him between these two shows, but still, probably the closest thing to a Rick Rude moment we're ever going to see today. Gargano said he'd be wrestling Apollo Crews on this show, and Tyler Breeze, who is opposing Crews at TakeOver, showed up, and he challenged Ciampa to a match later on. We got an Asuka video package with footage from her wrestling in Japan, which was very cool. This is footage I had not seen before. Apollo Crews pinned Johnny Gargano with his standing moonsault. Really good match. Ciampa and Breeze was longer, but I like this match more. These guys have wrestled each other before, which you can tell. If they sign Gargano full-time, I still believe, you know, the dude will be a star. I mean, there's something about him, besides the fact that he's small and that probably works against him, but there's something about him that may also work against him, and I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just his mannerisms. I don't know, but there's something about him that reminds me of Christian. And ordinarily, I wouldn't say that's a bad thing at all, but this is WWE, and we know how Vince McMahon felt about Christian, so I don't know that that's such a good thing. But, you know, and again, I can't quite put my finger on what it is. It's not necessarily his moveset. Maybe it is just a mannerism kind of thing. He's coming out. He's got his hand up on his forehead like he's looking out to the crowd. It reminded me of Christian. But Gargano is great. I would love for him to get a real shot. William Regal had Dana Brooke and Emma in his office. They were talking smack about Asuka when Regal picked up his laptop and told him he had something he wanted them to see. We never saw the video, but we could hear Asuka screaming like she was disemboweling somebody, and suddenly Dana and Emma's smiles turned to looks of horror, with Emma telling Dana, "Yeah, good luck with that," and she walked away. Later on, we saw what Regal had showed them. It was just Asuka kicking bags in a gym. She wasn't kicking ass. She looked very mean doing it, though. Very intimidating. I think bad things are about to happen to Dana Brooke. Emma and Dana came out for a tag team match against Billy Kay and Peyton Royce late in the match. Peyton went for what I think was maybe a drop kick off the middle rope. I'm not too sure, because she slipped and fell flat on her face. And the announcers tried to cover for her, but even they had to admit they did not quite know what she was going for. Dana won with her sit-out Death Valley driver. Backstage, Jason Jordan and Chad Gable talked about their match with Corbin and Rhino in the semifinals at TakeOver. Jason Jordan wants to be called JJ from now on. Dash and Dawson interrupted them. They're also in the semifinals. And they started arguing with them over who lost their match. They had that big eight-man tag team match at TakeOver. Actually, it was taped at TakeOver, but I don't think it aired until NXT the following week. But they were still arguing over whose fault it was that they lost the match. I guess this was supposed to be a tease that maybe these two teams would be in the finals of the Dusty Classic. There is exactly a 0% chance that that will be your final match in this tournament. Okay? Zero. Tyler Breeze pinned Tommaso Ciampa with Christian's Unprettier, speaking of Christian, which it looks like it may be Tyler's new finisher. I mean, which, if that's the case, I find that disappointing, because I still think the supermodel kick should be his finish. But, you know, the Unprettier name does work for his gimmick, so I guess maybe that's why they went with it. This was also a really good match. Ciampa got a lot more offense than Gargano did against Apollo Crews. Lots of near falls in this match, so even in defeat, they made Ciampa look good. Again, I don't know exactly what their status is with NXT, but they certainly, even in defeat, are putting these guys over as threats. Show ended with a video package for the main event at TakeOver that may have been better than the video that aired before the Sasha Bailey match. As fucking great as that video was, this one may have been better. This was excellent. They showed highlights from the entire match in Brooklyn. All the key spots, all the key moments set to this dramatic music. Even Bailey's crazy reverse Rana in slow motion was in there, where Sasha almost broke her neck. They had clips of all the boys in the back, including Kevin Owens, who was about to go out for his main event against Finn Balor. He's back there applauding the women as they came through the curtain. Then they went all Brett vs. Shawn on us with clips of each woman training for their Iron Maiden match. Make sure you watch this video before you watch that match at TakeOver. Although, I mean, they'll probably just replay it on there anyway. But this is required viewing before you watch that Iron Maiden match. If this does not get you pumped up for that match, then I don't know what will. Which reminds me, on Twitter this week, Kurt Angle was doing a Q&A, and he called Sasha Banks, this is what he said, he called Sasha maybe the most gifted female wrestler he has ever seen. That's some pretty high praise coming from a guy who won a gold medal in the Olympics, and will probably go down as one of the greatest pro wrestlers of all time. So I laugh whenever I see somebody crapping on Sasha because they think, oh, she's overrated. You know, just to be the contrarian point of view, right? It's one thing to say you don't like her, she's not your favorite, but there are people who will go out of their way to say, oh, she sucks, and she's completely overrated, and she can't wrestle, and I've never seen a good Sasha Banks match, and that's when I know they're just being different for the sake of being different. There's no way to justify that point of view. I mean, I do think it's a little overboard when somebody turns around, and I've had people email me and say this, that, oh, you know, do you think that when Sasha Banks goes into the Hall of Fame, and I'm like, dude, she's 23, like, calm down. Let's slow down a little bit. But she is not overhyped by any means. In every big match I've ever seen her in on one of these TakeOver shows, whether it was the match with Charlotte, the four-way, the first match with Bayley, this woman has consistently just knocked it out of the park. She's got that character down to a T. I remember when she first started on NXT and she was this very timid babyface, And I think it might have been Summer Rae. You know, I still remember that segment. They're in the backstage area, and you see there's a mirror in the locker room. And I think it was Summer who was talking smack to Sasha and basically telling... I forgot exactly what her verbiage was, but it was a moment for that Sasha Banks character where she had to literally look in the mirror as she was doing in that segment and figure out what her next move was going to be. And that's, I think, when the heel turn began and she became this boss character. And to see her now as compared to then, it's actually pretty cool that we... You know, they were doing NXT at the time, and we had the opportunity to really see that character and see her as a performer evolve, right? You don't get to see that on Raw. They just kind of throw you into the fire, and then when they're done with you, they cast you aside. But on NXT, you're actually able to see. It's a developmental show, so you're able to see these characters develop. And so I remember watching her back when I didn't think much of her to her today, and it's a pretty incredible transformation. So she's not overhyped by any means. When you have somebody like Kurt Angle make a comment like that when he doesn't have to, he went out of his way to single out Sasha as maybe the best he's ever seen. And that means something. And I echo what Kurt said. So let's talk about this TakeOver Respect show this Wednesday. They're back at Full Sail. Samoa Joe and Finn Balor against Dash and Dawson. Semi-final match in the Dusty Classic. I'm going with Joe and Balor. We also have Jason Jordan and Chad Gable against Baron Corbin and Rhino in the other semifinal match. If you ask me, who do I want to win this match? Who do I want to win the entire thing? It's easily Jordan and Gable. I think they've got a very high ceiling. I am thoroughly entertained. I mean, Jason Jordan is no slouch. Chad Gable is just fucking fantastic. Backstage on the microphone, in the ring. Thoroughly entertained every time I see this guy on TV. I would love to see them go all the way. And I think winning that trophy... It would, especially for Gable, it would really play into the character. But I don't think they're going to win. And I think Corbin and Rhino are going to win, unfortunately. And I think we're going to get a final of Joe and Balor against Corbin and Rhino. And I still maintain, even though I'm having my doubts, but I'm going with Joe and Balor as my pick. And then something happens. Again, it doesn't have to be a heel turn. It could be straight up respect. Joe gets in his face and challenges him. I think the end game here is going to be a championship match between Balor and Joe in London at TakeOver in December. How they get there, I'm not entirely sure, but I think we see the first step of that at TakeOver, and that's why I think they win. So I am going with them as my pick, even though I admit I may be wrong. Dana Brooke and Asuka, is there any debate on this? I think Asuka gets the win. Apollo Crews and Tyler Breeze. You know, Apollo Crews is going to have to lose at some point. I would love for them to shock everybody and give Breeze the win, but I don't expect it. So I'm going with Apollo Crews as my prediction to win the match. I mentioned the finals of the Dusty Rhodes Classic. I think it's going to be Balor and Joe. Cody and Dustin Rhodes will be there to present the winners, whomever they may be, with a trophy. See, now, if I were booking this, I would book it for Jordan and Gable to win. And then after the match, when Cody and Dustin present them with the trophy, they're completely full of themselves. And Cody and Dustin end up attacking them, and it leads to a match, maybe the following week on NXT, between the Rhodes brothers and Jason Jordan and Chad Gable. I would love to see that, but that's just my little bit of fantasy booking. And the main event on the show for the first time ever, the women will main event. Sasha Banks and Bayley, 30-minute Iron Maiden match for the women's championship. Now, I noticed that the show is listed, if you look at the network schedule, the show is listed from 8 p.m. Eastern to 10:30. So it's listed for 2.5 hours this time. It's going a little longer than usual, which makes me think, if I had to venture a prediction here, they will do a deal where both women are tied at the 30-minute mark, and they will go into overtime for a few minutes. Not very long, maybe 5 minutes or less. But they'll go into overtime, a la Bret and Shawn at WrestleMania 12, with William Regal this time playing the role of Gorilla Monsoon. Bayley wins, and when the match is over, Nia Jax finally makes her debut. I've never seen a woman coming for so long in my entire life. This woman's been coming for months. She will finally make her debut and lay out Bayley. And that will be your next program for the Women's Championship. I don't think it's going to be Bayley and Dana Brooke. I don't think it's going to be Bayley and Eva Marie, God forbid. I think it's going to be Bayley and Nia Jax. And that is your card for NXT TakeOver. Now, there is a new Table for Three that's airing after TakeOver at 10:30. with Dean Ambrose, Cesaro, and Kevin Owens talking about their indie experiences, among other things. That sounds like a must-watch. The last table for three with Daniel Bryan, Dolph Ziggler, and Ryback is, honest to God, one of the most entertaining things I've seen all year on WWE television. Much more entertaining than Raw has been lately. And it's only 26 minutes long. Especially the story about Brock Lesnar coming back in 2012 and Ryback, this is as Bryan tells it, Ryback trying to impress Brock by taking Cialis, which actually didn't happen, spoiler, but Bryan is just ribbing this guy nonstop. Ryback doesn't even travel with him anymore, and he talks about why. And everyone's laughing. It's fucking hysterical, the stories they're telling. And, you know, Ryback laughs a little bit too, but you can kind of tell, like, he really is bothered by all of the crap that he had to go through. And Daniel Bryan just ribbing him, and he just couldn't take it anymore. And he's like, you know what? That's why I travel alone. Because of you and Cody. He talks about Cody, too. He says, Bryan and Cody would make his life hell. And now, the Ryback travels all by himself. All because of Daniel Bryan. That big bully. That could be his new gimmick when he comes back. Big Bully Bryan. Or, not so big bully Bryan, I guess.
Solomonster, this is Brian Blade on behalf of the rest of our Horseman crew hijacking your show because we would all like to wish you a very happy birthday coming up this Tuesday. Gentlemen.
And this is Webmaster Mike wishing you a happy birthday and congratulations on 8 years of the Sound Off.
Solomonster, it's your birthday. Get crazy, get stupid. 400 plus episodes of the Solomonster Sounds Off, 8 years. You are a legend, my friend, so have a happy birthday, and I'm sure I'll see you at WrestleMania, maybe even before that. You never know when Noah the Mark is going to show up. That's me. Happy birthday, Solomonster.
And in closing, I think I could speak for the rest of the horsemen when I say, WWE, please give us a decent Monday Night Raw so our good buddy Solomonster isn't pissed off the next day, or at least not too pissed off. Have a good one, buddy, and have a lot of Captain and Cokes. Woo!
Thank you very much. That was very kind of them to send that little greeting in. And for anybody wondering what they could do for yours truly's birthday, those t-shirts aren't going to buy themselves. Just saying. TNA has its Bound for Bankruptcy pay-per-view tonight. Supposedly their version of WrestleMania. I've asked this question before. I'll ask it again. If a pay-per-view airs and nobody watches it, did it really happen? We're about to find out. One of our listeners works for Ticketmaster and checked on sales for Bound for Glory tickets. This was as of Wednesday. So 4 days before the show, they only had 270 tickets sold through Ticketmaster. For a building with a capacity of 5,000, 270 tickets sold, and some of that includes comps. So I don't know what more can be said about that. On Monday at noon, Eastern Time, Dixie Carter is hyping a major announcement. You know how these major announcements usually go with Dixie Carter. You know, we're using paper instead of plastic now, that kind of thing. More than likely, though, it's the announcement of an India tour. They've been planning for a while now. They're going to be taping TV in India at the end of November and building around that Mahabali Shara guy. But I went on Twitter and I asked you guys a few days ago to pretend like you didn't know that. Pretend it's not the India tour. Pretend you have no idea what Dixie's big announcement is going to be and send me your ideas. I'd like to read a few of the better ones here now, if I may. Just take a few moments. So these are your ideas as to what this big announcement could be. Bram has re-signed a long-term contract with TNA. Well, I mean, you know that one was coming. I had to mention that one. Vince Russo is returning as the head of creative. God forbid. I should block that person for even suggesting that. TNA is going to 3 hours. Now, you do not laugh at that, because if you go on the Destination America website right now, they have Impact's season premiere on October 14th listed as a 3-hour show. It says 180 minutes. But I don't think that's the announcement. But that is actually, I won't laugh too hard at that. It's actually kind of scary. They are doing a 3-hour show. This person says they are re-signing with Spike TV. See, now that's funny. That's a good one. That's one of the funnier ones I've read. Dixie announces her Eat, Sleep, Go Out of Business tour. Due to budget cuts, all rings will now be three-sided. A triangle ring. That would be very interesting. CM Punk still has not signed with WWE, meaning that TNA's chances of signing him are, quote, looking brighter. I could see Dixie saying that. And Ryan said, I'll recall the funniest meme of all time and say that YY has signed with Impact Wrestling. Yes, YY. Of course, YY being the former ZZ of Tough Enough fame. And finally here, this person says, TNA to introduce JWoww to the celebrity wing of the TNA Hall of Fame. I guess she would be joining Earl Hebner, who is also being inducted. Actually, I think he was inducted last night. I think TNA had a house show somewhere in the Carolinas last night. They were actually doing his induction at the house show. They were having Billy Corgan induct him, I guess, because that's where Earl Hebner, the Hebner family, is from. So that's kind of weird. I think it already happened. But anyway, those are your suggestions, which really are as good as any, as far as what this big Dixie announcement is. But again, I do think it probably is that India tour, which is really not all that big. Maybe big for them in terms of them taping TV because they have really no new TV taped. I don't really quite know how they're going to fill TV over the next month and a half before they head over to India, but I guess they'll cobble together some clips. Let's talk Ring of Honor. Ring of Honor on Destination America this week. More interpromotional battles between the Ring of Honor stars and the stars of New Japan Pro Wrestling, which always makes for a great wrestling show. It opened with Matt Sydal against the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champion Kushida. And Sydal beat Kushida with the Shooting Star Press. That surprised me. It surprised me that Kushida, being a title holder in New Japan, that they would put Sydal over him. But as the show went on and given the main event and who went over in the main event, I guess, you know, tit for tat, it kind of makes sense. Takaki Watanabe won a four-corner survival match over Moose, Adam Page, and Will Ferrara when Watanabe pinned Ferrara with a brutal-looking STO. And the main event was Shinsuke Nakamura against Adam Cole. Nakamura was showered in so many streamers, you could barely see him. You could see him, a little bit of him, through the streamers. Nakamura won with the Bomae knee. Great match. And really, I kind of undersold the opening match with Sydal and Kushida. That was also a great match. But Nakamura and Adam Cole gets the award for match of the week. This was just great. I know, you know, big surprise. We put Nakamura in the ring with Adam Cole, and they somehow end up having a great match. So I'm not going to do the play-by-play. I would just say go find it. There are ways, if you do not have Destination America, to find Ring of Honor online. I would implore you to go ahead and do so. And I would also say this, and I think I've said this before. As much of a fan as I became of Matt Stryker and Vampiro, and it's sad that even though Lucha Underground is coming back, it will probably be a new announced team. It'll be Stryker with somebody completely new, I assume. I would say they became my favorite. But Kevin Kelly and Steve Corino deserve a mention because they are, probably by default, in my opinion, the best announced team right now in all of wrestling. And I say that not having seen any of the recent New Japan shows on Access Television because I don't have Access. And I know Mauro Ranallo and Josh Barnett, I think they do commentary for that show. They're great. So I'm not forgetting about them. But just consistently week to week, based on what I'm seeing, Kevin Kelly and Steve Corino are as good as it gets. I mean, they're a really, really good announced team. I'm not completely sick of hearing Corino like I am pretty much every other play-by-play guy in wrestling. They work really well together, and I just, you know, I wanted to mention that. And speaking of Kevin Kelly, I'm going to get to him actually in a moment. I want to get to one other thing before I get to Kevin Kelly. One last Ring of Honor note. There was a tweet that somebody sent me this morning. I was not aware of any of this. And they asked me, hey, have you been following this back and forth between Jim Cornette and Kenny King? And I had no idea what he was talking about. So apparently Jim Cornette on his latest podcast, you can find it. It's on MLWRadio.com, episode 96. You can go listen to it for yourself. Cornette gives an explicit detail, the blow-by-blow about what he's talking about here. It's about 20 minutes long. So go up there, find the podcast. It's about 44 minutes in. He went off on Kenny King because Kenny King worked for Ring of Honor back when Cornette was was there. I guess he was booking him and Delirious. Hunter Johnston was the booker, and Cornette was still working for ROH, and they were planning the shows out and the storylines and whatnot. And at the time, Kenny King was part of a tag team called the All Night Express with Rhett Titus. And Cornette, again, he'll go into the specifics if you care enough to go back and just listen to him talk about it in his own words. And I will say this, it's one side of the story. Kenny King has not said much. He posted a few tweets completely burying Cornette and saying that he's deciding how best, like what avenue he wants to use to give his side of the story. So we are only getting one person's side. Kenny King has not yet had a chance to explain himself or defend himself. But Cornette goes into pretty explicit detail, dates and that kind of thing as far as things that happen. And the basic gist is this. When Kenny King showed up in TNA, I didn't know much in the way of how it all came down and what happened, but I had been of the impression that he had burned a bridge with Ring of Honor. And apparently not, because Kenny King is now back in Ring of Honor as of a few weeks ago. He's been gone from TNA, I guess, for a while, but he has now returned to Ring of Honor. And Jim Cornette has nothing but respect for Delirious as a booker. He really praised the hell out of him and said he's one of the best he's ever had the chance to work alongside, but he thinks it was a big mistake for Ring of Honor to let this guy back because it sets a bad precedent for somebody who really fucked over that company. And Cornette gives some of the backstory that I didn't know about what happened way back when, because he just kind of showed up in TNA and seemingly left Ring of Honor high and dry, and that's what Cornette gets into. And they had plans to put the titles on Rhett Titus and Kenny King. You know, and again, Cornette has his opinions on Kenny King. He doesn't think he was very good. He calls him a male stripper, and which I guess he was. He worked at Chippendales. I don't know if he still does. But he was even on, was it Tough Enough? There was that one episode of Tough Enough. I think Kenny King was actually a Chippendales dancer. No, it wasn't Tough Enough. It was Legends House. There's an episode of Legends House on the network where they brought the Legends out to Vegas and they were doing a Chippendales show and Kenny King was there. So Cornette just goes off on, oh, he's a male stripper. He doesn't give a shit about wrestling. He was more concerned about that and, you know, fucking whores and all this other stuff. And that may well be true. But the two big teams in Ring of Honor at the time were the Briscoes and Haas and Benjamin. And as he explains it, Rhett Titus is the one who I really feel sorry for in this story. It really sounds like Rhett Titus was just kind of caught in the crossfire of all this. Kenny King wasn't sure if he wanted to sign a long-term deal. He had signed like a one-year contract with the company, even though they wanted him, I guess, to sign for longer. His contract was coming up, and as Cornette explains, they really couldn't beat them, because if they would have beaten Titus and Kenny King again at that point, the team would have been dead. They wanted to put the titles on them to keep them going. So they were going to have them beat Haas and Benjamin to become the new Ring of Honor Tag Team Champions. And he tells the whole thing, there was nothing but problems. They were putting the belts on these two guys, and yet Kenny King had a problem with the finish, and he had different ideas about how it should go down. But the bigger issue was they came to an agreement with him to sign a 90-day extension to his contract, because they wanted to put the titles on him and Rhett Titus, but they knew that Kenny King had told them, listen, you know, I may have an in at TNA. There may be an opening for me there. And they said to him, listen, that's cool. We'll have you sign a 90-day extension because we want to put the belts on you. We don't want it to be a situation where we make you the champs and then you bolt for another promotion. So we'll give you the chance to negotiate whatever deal you think you may be able to get with TNA, but we also want to protect ourselves. And Cornette takes responsibility for not having the signed contract in time. They were supposed to get the contract signed by Kenny King that day. They had a gentleman's agreement. Kenny King ends up not signing the contract. They put the belts on them. It's just a whole mess. Long story short, Kenny King did end up going to TNA. And he really fucked over Ring of Honor. And Jim Cornette is not happy about it. Jim Cornette does not think very highly at all of Kenny King. And again, he doesn't agree with the fact that they welcomed him back after what he did to them. It's one person's side of the story. It does not make Kenny King look good at all. It really doesn't. And so I'm very anxious myself to hear what Kenny King has to say about all this, because it does not reflect well on him. And I get it. You know, wrestlers, these guys are independent contractors. They have to look out for themselves and get the best deal. Based on what Cornette was saying, him and Ring of Honor were giving Kenny King the opportunity to make whatever deal would make him the most money, even if that meant leaving. They just wanted to protect themselves, which makes sense. And Kenny King had other ideas. So we'll see. We'll see what Kenny King's side of the story is. But if you ever wonder what the hell went down when he left Ring of Honor and why there seemed to be a lot of bad blood there, Cornette was there at the time, and he gives his side of the story, and it's pretty damning stuff. And again, he's very specific with dates and names and all that kind of thing, and says he even has evidence of some stuff that they had talked about, and we'll see what Kenny King has to say about it. But again, if you want to hear Cornette in his own words, it's episode 96. It's up on MLWRadio.com, about 45 minutes in. He talks about it for about 15, 20 minutes in a very colorful way, as only Cornette can, so just be aware of that. But one last note here, back to the Kevin Kelly thing I mentioned earlier. If you have a subscription to New Japan World, like I do, even though I never use it, seriously, I have been paying for New Japan World. It's like $8 a month. I've been paying for this thing for months, and I have not watched any of the recent shows. It's sad. It's just hard to find time. And my problem is my laptop heats up whenever I try to stream this thing, and it dies. It gets very, very hot, as my laptop, which is now 6 years old, is prone to do. And for whatever reason, when I try to stream, like the WWE Network especially, but the WWE Network, I'll just usually watch it on my 4-inch iPhone screen or on my television. I haven't been able to quite do that yet with New Japan World. So my laptop will heat up and die. It's like I can't even fucking watch this thing even when I want to. So I've been paying for this and I haven't watched anything. But anyway, if you do have a subscription, next Monday, October 12th, they are having their King of Pro Wrestling event headlined by AJ Styles against Okada for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship. The winner will likely defend the title in the main event of Wrestle Kingdom in January. It's probably going to be Okada and Tanahashi again, I would imagine, with Okada winning this time. He's never beaten Tanahashi at a Wrestle Kingdom show. So that's the storyline they've been building now for the longest time. But I mention this because this show next Monday will have English commentary. They will have live English commentary for the first time ever on New Japan World for this show. Kevin Kelly and Matt Stryker are the ones who are handling the commentary. They are flying to Japan. They're not going to be sitting in a studio somewhere. They're going out to Japan. They're handling the commentary for the show. First time ever that they're doing this. And they're in the middle of a free trial period right now. It starts today, actually, October 4. It goes through next Sunday, the 11th, which is the day before the show. But there is a free trial period right now. If you want to give New Japan World a shot, I believe they have an English sign-up screen. Just search around for it. If not, you can translate it. There's a translate function. Now would be the time to sign up and give it a shot. You know, just because I haven't been able to watch much from it doesn't mean that you shouldn't. There's a lot of great stuff up there, and now would be a good time to sample it. So I just wanted to mention that for anybody who might be interested. Let's get to the mailbag. I got a ton of questions from you guys. You can keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com, even though I wish you wouldn't. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm way, 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 way behind on emails. And so when I look at my email bubble on my iPhone home screen, see, here's the thing. I have a few different email accounts. So I have a personal email, and the Gmail for the show forwards everything to my main email, so I don't miss it. That's why when I tell you guys I read all of your emails, I do. Even if I don't get back to you, if I don't use it, don't be offended. I do see everything that you send me. And unfortunately, I have allowed my primary inbox to get to the point now where before, it was about 35, 40 emails. That's a good number of emails for my inbox, my private inbox at any given moment. And with all the emails that are being forwarded from the podcast account, that email bubble now says, I think last time I checked, it was 1,064. So I have a lot of catching up to do. And just be aware, if I don't respond or if you don't hear your question on the show, it may eventually be, but even if it doesn't, please just bear with me here, because it's taking a while to go through everything. But we did get some good questions this week. We'll start with Jason. Jason says, I was curious to hear your thoughts on WWE telling pro wrestling tees they cannot sell Jim Neidhart shirts because he has a Legends deal with them. But WWE sells no Jim Neidhart shirts, so what is their problem? I understand legally they have every right to shut that down, but it just seems petty to me. Stuff like this is why I no longer watch Raw or have the WWE Network. It's just hard for me to support them anymore. Well, look, a contract is a contract, right? If Neidhart signed a deal with WWE, then it's his responsibility to let Pro Wrestling Tees or whoever know that, hey, I've got a deal and these are the terms. It's very easy for people to crap all over WWE. WWE comes off as the bad guy here, but I think people are they're not understanding that, right? If this guy signed a contract, then that's a binding contract. Now, I feel bad for Pro Wrestling Tees more than anything else because it's not their fault. They're trying to do right by all these wrestlers. They're giving them an outlet to make money. I think what they do is great. I don't know what the t-shirt situation is for Jim Neidhart, but I do know that he's on the WWE 2K16 roster. I know that. And the wrestlers generally make pretty good money off those video games. Now, how that works with the legends, I don't know. I know a lot of the current main roster guys have made quite a bit of money when they get those video game checks. So for a guy like a Jim Neidhart or a Vader, I don't know how they work that out. But, you know, supposedly it's their biggest roster ever for one of those video games. So, you know, maybe the guys won't make as much this time. But those games are very lucrative, and Neidhart made the cut. So let's not be too quick to judge here. The one who I feel bad for the most is Pro Wrestling Tees, because they're just trying to do the right thing. Philip from Germany, my question concerns RVD. I know he and WWE had an agreement that he works for a period of time and then gets his rest, but the last time I think we saw him was in the summer of 2014. Does WWE simply have no ideas for him, or is RVD not interested in working at the moment? He still has an open agreement with WWE that he comes and goes as he pleases. Right now, he has no interest in coming back. He's keeping very busy. He has said he does not see himself coming back for a while. So if you see him anywhere, it will not be TNA. It will not be ROH. It will not be Lucha Underground. It will be WWE. He does have a merchandising agreement with them and all that kind of stuff. He just doesn't want to come back right now. It's as simple as that. Hassan from Atlanta. Kane has 18 championships during his time in WWE, 12 of which are tag team titles. My question is, do you consider Kane a tag team specialist? Also, besides The Undertaker, who do you think was his best tag team partner? It's weird that he's won all those tag titles. I don't really think of him as this great tag team specialist. To me, he's still a singles guy. He's still headlining shows after all these years. But he's probably had about 6 different partners over the years, right? Undertaker, Big Show, Mankind, X-Pac, RVD, Hurricane. Am I missing anybody? I think those are the ones. Those are the main ones. And you say, besides Undertaker, you know, who is the best tag team partner? I'm not so sure I'd even pick Undertaker as number one. I was a really big fan of the Kane and X-Pac pairing. I think I like them the most. You know, big guy, little guy. They complemented each other very well. And plus, you know, X-Pac got him to speak for the first time without that damn voice box. Joe from Nashville. Why did The Undertaker never replace Hulk Hogan in 1992 as the face of WWE? He had the look, the size, was over with the fans, and was probably the biggest babyface behind Warrior and Savage after Hogan left. And if he did replace Hogan, how do you think WWE business would have been? There's a difference between being popular and moving the needle, right? Some people would even say that about Daniel Bryan, right? He was very popular. But it wasn't like when he was on TV, ratings went up, or when he would headline one of the house show tours that they were doing as well as the John Cena tours were. And that's a fair thing to say. So there's a big difference between being popular and really moving the needle. Undertaker never moved the needle the way that Hogan did, or Austin, or Cena, or any of the top guys. Simple as that. Business was already pretty dead around that time in 92. But it would have been deader than The Undertaker himself if they positioned him as the number one babyface. And he was rarely out of character back during that period, right? Now it wouldn't be an issue, but back then he was always The Undertaker. It just wouldn't have worked. He really wasn't this huge draw that some people think he was, even in the Attitude Era. You know, as part of a cast of characters, yeah, sure. He was surrounded by Undertaker Rock and Austin and guys like that. He could work with them. But on his own, he was never really this big draw that brought in you know, new fans or that filled the arenas and popped a huge segment on TV or even sold that much merch. I never really heard of Undertaker being a big, like, T-shirt seller or anything like that. All those metrics that you would look at for a guy, it was off the charts for a Hogan or an Austin or a Cena. Undertaker was never that guy. But, you know, as the sole top babyface, the number one guy, no way. No way. Even in 92, he was very popular, but no way. I don't think it would have worked. He was never at that level. Jonathan says, did WCW countersue WWF when Vince sued WCW for Scott Hall's likeness to Razor Ramon with the hairstyle and the toothpick gimmick when Scott had already used it years prior to WWF in WCW as the Diamond Stud? Also, how do you feel about Carlos Colon being in the WWE Hall of Fame after the Bruiser Brody incident? I don't think WCW countersued them. I know they did sue them a couple of years after that for something completely unrelated. I think it had to do with the the billionaire Ted skits. I don't think it ever went anywhere. As far as Carlos Colon, I don't care for him being in the Hall of Fame. The fact that he still employed Invader, who murdered Bruiser Brody, after what happened, I think is revolting. I was at the Hall of Fame ceremony the year he was inducted, and I took a nap during his induction. Aaron has a question about Phil Mushnick of the New York Post, Vince McMahon's old pal. He says, we all know of Phil Mushnick's seething hatred for Vince McMahon, WWE, and pro wrestling. But what I've always wanted to know is what triggered it. It's one thing to not like something, but if that's the case, one would simply pay no attention to it. Well, let me stop you right there. That's not always true. Just look at all the people who still watch Raw every week. Although that number is dwindling, but I digress. Mushnick seems to have made it his personal mission to absolutely destroy wrestling. What could have brought this on? Was it something personal that happened between he and Vince? I'm not aware of anything that ever happened between Vince McMahon and Phil Mushnick. I'm not even sure they've ever met in person. For those who don't know, give a little backstory here. Phil Mushnick is a columnist for the New York Post. He writes a sports column. He still does, after all these years. He also seems like the most miserable person on planet Earth. Never a positive thing to say about anybody or anything. He's always ragging on somebody or ragging on this announcers for this football team or this network or something. There's always something for him to really just complain about. Ironically, he would fit in quite well with the wrestling audience online. But really, I've never been a regular reader of the guy's work because every time, even now, when I do try to read some of his stuff, it's just insufferable. Absolutely insufferable. He first started writing about Vince McMahon and WWF in the late 80s. Guy started dropping dead. And the steroid scandal exploded, kind of like the hearts of a lot of guys who were working for Vince McMahon at the time. They exploded too. And his problem was more the hypocrisy of Vince McMahon and his product. Yeah, the product at the time was geared towards children, even more than it is today. And yet, behind the scenes, you had, you know, almost everybody on the roster was doing drugs of some kind and steroids, and you had sex scandals and all this awful stuff. And he would also talk about how wrestling was kind of a sideshow circus that the mainstream media didn't ever pay any attention to. And all this stuff was routinely being swept under the rug, so he may have felt some kind of, you know, moral obligation to cover it and kind of be a thorn in Vince McMahon's side because nobody else would be. And Vince hated his guts for it, just absolutely hated this guy's guts. Before Eric Bischoff and Ted Turner came along and the federal government and all that, there was Phil Mushnick. Okay, he was the original enemy for Vince McMahon. And Vince thought it was just one giant conspiracy against him. You know, I remember this, one of the more random things I've ever seen on WWE television was Vince McMahon's rant on Phil Mushnick and the New York Post on an episode of Superstars back in 95. This was well after Vince was acquitted on all the steroid stuff. Vince was so gotten to by Mushnick. He accused the guy of conspiring with the feds to help bring the charges against him in the first place. You know, like this New York Post columnist is conspiring with the federal government to bring down Vince McMahon. So let me play the audio for you, because I pulled it. When I got this question, I went and I pulled the audio. I've edited it down a little bit. But this is most of it. So this is going to go on for just a few minutes. This is what WWF inserted into that episode of Superstars back in 95. This is Vince McMahon, in his own words, going off on Phil Mushnick and the New York Post.
This is Vince McMahon, the World Wrestling Federation. I've always made it a point to refrain from personal commentary during WWF programming, but please permit me this one exception. As many of you know, several years ago, the World Wrestling Federation and I came under a vicious attack by the tabloid media, led by one Phil Mushnick of the New York Post. It's been the equivalent, in my view, of journalistic stalking. As we found out, these stalkers apparently are not interested in the truth, as they have been heard to say in the tabloid newsroom, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. Mr. Mushnick attempted to give credibility to this type of tabloid investigation by telling his readers the feds don't waste money on witch hunts. Now, most people, myself included, naively believe that government prosecutors and their investigators are the good guys. Unfortunately, I found this to not always hold true. I was constantly amazed at the utter lack of ethics of some of the good guys involved in my case, all of whom had demonstrable ties to Mr. Phil Mushnick. I watched the good guys lie to the media, lie to the judge, lie to the jury. I watched the good guys get caught because they tried to pressure my alleged co-conspirator into changing his prior sworn testimony. I watched as the good guys were forced to admit that they had destroyed evidence. And I saw the ultimate impact of the truth when the jury acquitted me and the World Wrestling Federation without us even having to put on a defense or call even one witness. Although I had a great deal to say about this unique life experience at the time after the trial, I did not. However, recent events compel me now to speak. The day before Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving Eve, Mr. Mushnick in the New York Post wrote two new articles. One article was entitled, Tampering Cloud Over Wrestling Biggs Trial. It cites unnamed federal sources as suggesting that Marty Bergman, the husband of one of my attorneys, Laura Bivetti, tampered with witnesses, obstructed justice, and caused a baseless complaint to be filed against the good guys who were Phil Mushnick's cronies with the Justice Department. Now, the WWF and I were exonerated by a jury of my peers. None of these good guys have ever been, nor in my view, ever would be exonerated in any fair public hearing as the WWF and I were. The second article actually goes to the absurd depth of quoting the ever-present unnamed sources as questioning the marriage of Laura Bivetti and Marty Bergman. I also deeply resent any innuendo or accusation that my acquittal on the charges brought against me by the federal government was in any way tainted by any illegality by me or by my legal representation. These same Keystone cops who wasted taxpayer dollars, these same yellow journalists who had to eat crow for telling lies, are once again incestuously joining forces, trying to drum up support for their own personal agenda, trying to manufacture some reason to save face, attempting to perpetuate some theory of witness tampering. Gentlemen, is that the best you can do? That postulation of witness tampering is about as far-fetched as the charges originally brought against me in the first place. The jury did not believe you then. Why should the public believe you now? Or should yellow journalists conspiring with vengeful federal officials be above reproach or even above the law? I don't think so.
So that was Vince McMahon 20 years ago. That's how long it's been since that aired. Vince is always the victim here. Whenever something happens, when someone goes after him or his company, he's always playing the victim card. So anyway, I don't know that Mushnick hates or even hated pro wrestling as much as he hated Vince McMahon and his version of pro wrestling and his company and what he turned wrestling into. I don't know that Mushnick, I mean, I don't know him personally, nor do I want to, but I doubt he would be writing columns bashing Bruno Sammartino back in the day, or, you know, Bob Backlund for inciting violence amongst children. He was bashing Vince McMahon for promoting his product to kids while all of this horrible stuff was going on that he felt Vince was responsible for. He thought Vince had blood on his hands for all the premature wrestler deaths. You know, I remember when they were promoting the 1,000th episode of Raw, Mushnick did a column where he wondered if they would air a roll call for all of the dead wrestlers that had appeared on the show over the years that were no longer alive. Thing is, a lot of what Mushnick has said over the years, as much as I don't like the guy, is kind of true. I'm not even sitting here saying that this guy is a liar and he hates wrestling fans, he's a piece of crap. You know, I am no fan of Phil Mushnick at all. But a lot of what he has said over the years, he's taken a lot of truth. And what he ends up doing is he just takes it too far, or he over-embellishes, or he steps over that line. You know, he's got this holier-than-thou attitude about things that just makes you cringe. I can't stand the guy. But let's be honest here. Vince McMahon is no angel either. And it amuses me every time this guy plays the victim card here. It's never his fault. He's always the victim. Everyone's always out to get him. And Mushnick has just been a thorn in his side for decades now. And even today, he'll still write columns about wrestling and talk about wrestling whenever something horrible happens, of course, because that's just the nature of his column. But the bad blood between the two of them goes back many, many, many years, and I doubt it'll ever go away until one of them goes away. Speaking of the colognes, we talked about Carlos Colon a little earlier. Jay from Chicago has a question. What was Carlito's downfall in WWE? And do you think the infamous No Passion backstage promo with Ric Flair was off script? Carlito is actually back on WWE's radar again from what I read. I guess they want to bring him in to do something maybe with his brother. Both colognes. The former Matadors, now that they've abandoned the Bull. We'll see. I guess the money isn't up to snuff so far. I don't think Carlito's coming back. I just don't think they'll be able to reach a deal. But they're at least talking, I guess. His downfall was this notion that they had at the time that he wasn't living up to his potential. You know, he wasn't motivated enough. I don't know if lazy is the right word for it, but he wasn't being all that he could be. The promo that Flair cut on him was absolutely planned, but it was a shoot. There was very much a lot of honesty behind those comments. They were trying to send a message to Carlito, and they were doing it through this scripted, planned promo on the show. Did he see it coming? I don't know. I would think he did. I would think he knew, but I can't say that for sure. I always thought Carlito could have been a big star. Now, maybe they were right. Maybe WWE was right about him. I don't know. But it just never happened. It never worked out. He could still be a big star. He left WWE. He got ripped. I don't know if you've seen pictures of him recently, but he's jacked compared to the way he used to be. Calls himself a body guy now. Right up Vince's alley. Maybe that's why they want him back so bad. Keith from New Jersey. You've mentioned that Triple H's Reign of Terror is one of your least favorite times in Raw history, and you'd instead prefer to watch SmackDown, which was a better show. I fully agree with you because on the other side of Raw, SmackDown had Brock Lesnar as WWE Champion, Big Show returning as a main eventer, and the Cruiserweight division resurrected. However, the best part of the SmackDown, or was the SmackDown 6, of Kurt Angle, Chris Benoit, Edge, Rey Mysterio, Eddie, and Chavo Guerrero. I would argue SmackDown's tag team division from 02 to 03 was some of the best tag team wrestling of any era. What are your thoughts of the SmackDown 6, and what is your favorite match or moment with any of those six men? The SmackDown 6 were great. Between those guys and Paul Heyman writing the show, there's never been a better period for SmackDown in the 16 years or whatever it is that it's been on the air than that period. It was the A show during that period. I would even argue that SmackDown, the SmackDown brand at that time with those six plus Lesnar and a few other guys who were on the roster, because they had some marquee names as well. Undertaker was there. I would argue that talent roster for SmackDown was maybe the second best ever for any major promotion in this country. You know, WCW at its peak would be number one. You really can't beat the talent roster they had going there for a while, like around 97. But that SmackDown roster was right behind it. If I had to pick a favorite match, you know, you're talking about tag team wrestling during that period. Well, I got a match. It's the first match that comes to mind. Yeah, I've been doing this countdown of 8 of my favorite matches in WWE history leading up to our 8-year anniversary show next month. This match is not on the list, but it probably should be. If I did a top 10, it would definitely be. It's one of my favorites. I recommend you check it out right now on the network. It's from No Mercy, 2002. Edge and Rey Mysterio in the finals of a tag team title tournament. They created a set of tag team belts for SmackDown. It was Edge and Rey Mysterio against Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit. One of the greatest tag team matches in the history of that company. Four guys in their prime. I mean, Edge was still kind of young, but this was before he went to go get neck surgery. Just a fantastic match. Absolutely fantastic match. So I would urge you to go back and check that out. If you want to see, you know, part of the SmackDown 6 at their best in action during that period, that's the match you got to go back and watch. Derek says, remember The Undertaker beating Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania this year? Yeah, me neither. I believe this has to be one of the most pointless matches in history, but I can't seem to think of any others. Can you name any other matches that immediately after they took place were basically forgotten and was completely pointless? Pretty much every SmackDown match. You know, there's a reason I say if it happened on SmackDown, it didn't happen. It's not just a t-shirt. That is a fact. William from Calgary. I look back to 1991, WrestleMania 7 and Macho King versus Ultimate Warrior in a career-ending match, which Warrior won. As a result, Randy Savage had to retire. Is there a story behind this? Did Randy retire due to injury, or was he legitimately done with wrestling? The story that I had always heard, and I believe to be true, is that he and Elizabeth wanted to have a kid. They wanted to start a family together, and so in order to do that, Savage had to get off of whatever stuff he was on at that time. The baby thing never happened. You know, Savage came back by the end of the year. Yeah, it's possible he had some nagging injuries, too, you know, that he wanted time off for, but I believe the family reason was the main thing. Nick from Germany. Buy or sell between who he believes are currently the two best wrestlers in the world. Shinsuke Nakamura or Seth Rollins? You seem to have misspelled AJ Styles in your email here. I think AJ is the best wrestler in the world right now, personally, but we'll go with your two guys. I'll play along here. Right now, I would buy Nakamura and sell Rollins, but I do think Rollins is the best in WWE, and he's also miscast. When he turns babyface, and he will, believe me, when he turns back babyface, ask me that question again. I may have a different answer. You know, those babyface comebacks when he was part of the Shield and he would tag into a match were something else. But for now, I'm buying Nakamura. Nakamura is just, he's on top of his game. He's entertaining. He's great in the ring. He's just got this, I don't know, he's got this personality about him that's just fun. It's just fun to watch. He's so charismatic. He's great in the ring. He's just the total package right now. And finally here, the Marauding Walnut, it's a great name, has a buy or sell on who is the better heel, Hollywood Rock in 2003 or heel Shawn Michaels in 2005. See, now, if you would have said heel Shawn Michaels 1997 or just heel Shawn Michaels in general and didn't assign a year, that would be the easy buy. And I think Shawn in 1997 was at his heelish best. But I'm going to buy on Hollywood Rock, and I'm selling Shawn from 2005. First of all, Shawn played heel for all of a month, and he didn't do anything particularly heelish during that period, aside from kicking Hulk Hogan in the face, which some people would say only made him more of a babyface. That one night in Montreal, he was fantastic. It was one of the all-time great segments in Raw history. I thought about giving it to Shawn just for that alone, but it's not enough. It was so easy for him to manipulate the fans that night, given where they were. I mean, it's fucking Montreal, what do you expect? But he was just fantastic in that opening interview segment in Montreal on that show. And then Bret Hart's music plays, and then he trolls the fans for. He was just great. Hollywood Rock lasted a little longer, and he was such a dick. He was such a smug dick during that period. He had that one night in Toronto. You know, Shawn had his night in Montreal. Rock had that great promo in Toronto that was almost as good as the Shawn one. And I see a common thread here with the Canadian fans. I have no idea why WWE doesn't run as many shows there anymore, especially in Toronto. At least their fans actually have a fucking pulse. But Hollywood Rock was great. The guy was such... He was such a boss. You want to know how much of a boss this guy was? He basically drafted himself from SmackDown to Raw. He just showed up, and nobody said a word. Who else could get away with that? He worked with the Hurricane during that run. He put the Hurricane over. He worked that Battle Royal before WrestleMania. He put Booker T over. That was for the title shot against Triple H at WrestleMania. I remember after Rock got dumped out of the Battle Royal, he was even sitting on the floor applauding Booker T. He was giving him a nice round of applause, and he was mouthing like how good he was. Now, maybe that's not totally heelish, but I loved Hollywood Rock. He was an entertaining heel who actually wanted to put other people over. I still say Rock is probably the most selfless main eventer in the history of that, at least that company. You know, Ric Flair may be the most selfless headliner ever, all time, with all the people that he's worked with and went out of his way to make them look good or put them over, all the jobs he did for people after Hogan and his cronies came into WCW. I mean, who else would have done that? Not Hogan, not Savage, not Piper, not Luger, probably not even Sting. Now, there's Ric Flair in the corner raising his hand. Yeah, I'll do the job. You know, and if anything, he did that too much. It actually ended up working against him. So I would still say Ric Flair is probably the most selfless headliner ever. But Rock, you know, Rock is right behind him, so maybe that doesn't go to the heelish part of what you asked about, but I just think he was a better heel. So I would buy on Rock and sell on Sean. And speaking of Sean, perfect segue here. This brings me to match number 3 in our countdown of the, again, I say top 8. It's not really top 8. It's 8 of my favorite matches. I'm not saying these are the absolute 8 favorites of mine, but these are 8 of my favorite all-time WWE matches that I have selected here for this countdown. And match number 1 was the 1992 Royal Rumble, which if I did rank this list, honestly, that probably would be number 1. Number 2 is Austin against Dude Love at Over the Edge in 98. Number 3 is my all-time favorite WrestleMania match, Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25. What can I say about this match? This match was everything that you would look for in a big-time main event WrestleMania match. It's a match that, in hindsight, absolutely should have gone on last and been the main event. And I think it hurt Triple H and Randy Orton to go on last. Not the first time that Triple H has gone on in the main event of a show and has been fucked over by a match earlier in the night that just sucked all the energy out of the crowd. It happened to him at WrestleMania 18 as well. This is a match that I wished would have happened a lot earlier than it did. Now, in hindsight, as great as this match was, you know, I'm happy things worked out the way they did, but Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker had a great rivalry in 1997. They did the deal at SummerSlam, where Shawn was the guest referee for the championship match. He accidentally caved Undertaker's head in with a chair shot and gave Bret Hart the title. And that sparked the initial feud. And it's kind of hard to believe as many years as they had spent together in the company even then, but when they had that match, that first match at the Ground Zero show in September of 1997, that was the first singles match on TV that Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker ever had. That was their very first meeting ever. And I remember that Ground Zero match for all the talk about the Hell in a Cell. That was a hell of a match. Now, there was a lot of interference and a lot of just, you know, there was a fuck finish in that match. A lot of stuff was going on. But that was actually a pretty wild match. And they followed that up the month after with the very first Hell in a Cell match. I still maintain to this day, Undertaker and Mankind, it's almost not even a match. That is the biggest spectacle I've ever seen in wrestling. But as a match, I still go with Undertaker and Shawn Michaels, that very first one, as being the best. They had a hell of a match. That's when Kane debuted. Now, they came back and they did the casket match at the Rumble in 98. It's a match that never should have happened because the feud should have ended with that Hell in a Cell match. There was no reason to rematch them again. And as it turned out, Shawn Michaels got hurt. He fucked up his back, and he was out of wrestling for 4.5 years. Had they not done that match, they could have done Shawn Michaels and Owen Hart, which seemed to be the direction they were going in when Owen came back. but they didn't do it. So Sean goes away for 4.5 years. He comes back. And I'm thinking to myself, now, first, nobody knew that Sean was going to come back for as long as he did. They thought he'd come back for one match, and then, okay, that went well. Maybe he'll have a match here and there. The fucking guy ends up coming back for another 8.5 years. I mean, not even he could have expected that. But as the years went on, I'm thinking to myself, man, they should do Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. And they got a great story built in. This fucking guy put Shawn Michaels on the shelf for 4.5 years. Now, yeah, Shawn's back was already messed up, but that injury legitimately put this guy out of action for years. It took away his livelihood. It took away his income. I mean, he was still getting paid, but you know, you can tell that story. Not only was Shawn still getting paid, by the way, I remember reading he was making $15,000 a week even when he was doing nothing those 4 years. So, you know, Shawn was on easy street. I don't cry for Shawn Michaels even when he was hurt, but there's this great story that you can tell of, you took away 4.5 years of my career in the prime of my career, and I missed the Attitude Era, all that kind of stuff, and Shawn now wants to get his revenge. He wants to have one more match with The Undertaker. And it seemed like year after year after year, they kept these guys apart. They didn't want them to have any sort of affiliation at all. They were intentionally keeping them apart, and it pissed me off. It's like, what are they doing here? So in the Royal Rumble match in 2007, that was the first time, I think, since Shawn came back all those years earlier, that they actually went one-on-one inside of a ring. They were the last two in the Rumble match. It was actually a pretty cool ending. Undertaker wins. They did another tease the next year. Undertaker and Shawn opened the Rumble, and it felt like, hey, this is going to be the year. They're finally going to match him up, and then they didn't do it again. So finally, the year after, they're going to do a fucking match with these guys. Like, it's about time. I thought they waited far too long. And not even that, they didn't even tell that story. So as great as this turned out to be, and the build-up and the match, and it's my favorite now in WrestleMania history, all of that is true, but they didn't tell the most obvious story that there was to tell. I don't remember them mentioning it, let alone focusing on it in the build-up to this match. It was more just, you have these two legends, Shawn Michaels, you know, ascending from heaven, The Undertaker coming up from hell. Remember the entrances for the match at WrestleMania? They told their own story. It was like they didn't want to mention anything that happened in the 1990s. I don't even remember them really mentioning the first Hell in a Cell. I mean, maybe they threw highlights in the video, but that to me was also a missed opportunity, because I think that would have been a much better story to tell. And Shawn doesn't have to come off in that case as being bitter or anything like that, but they wanted to tell their own story. It's kind of like when Undertaker and Triple H had their match at WrestleMania 27, and clearly the directive from Vince McMahon was, we are not to mention the fact that these two guys already had a WrestleMania match 10 years before, so let's just pretend it never happened. You know, Vince is Vince. I mean, what the hell are you going to do? But finally, they promote this match, and the video package was great, and the entrances were great, and they have the match. And the match starts out, you know, a little slow. They're going back and forth, different holds and whatnot. And pretty early in the match, Undertaker gets Shawn in a Hell's Gate. And the people are going crazy. They're actually buying into this as a possible finish. They could not have been more than maybe 10 minutes into the match at that point. And then the spot that everybody remembers, Undertaker, actually, is outside. Actually, before we get to that spot, there was a spot that came before the big dive that I thought was nuts. Undertaker's outside. Shawn climbs to the top rope. He does a moonsault. He does a moonsault off the top rope, and Undertaker just literally sideswipes him. He's like, yeah, get the fuck out of it. Like a fly that he's swatting away. And Shawn comes crashing down onto the ground. That was pretty sick to watch. So he hits with a thud. Undertaker gets back in the ring. Shawn's out there. Referee's out there with him. Undertaker's going for his big dive. At some point, this became the annual Undertaker dive. First time I ever remember Undertaker doing that dive, I believe, would have been at that Ground Zero show. I don't think I ever remember Undertaker doing that. Now, I'm not saying he didn't. And somebody, I'm sure, will correct me if I'm wrong, but it may have been that September 1997 Ground Zero show, because at the very end of that match with Undertaker and Michaels, all the wrestlers came out. They were trying to break everybody up, so you have this big pile of guys outside, and that's when Undertaker went. He did this suicide dive and completely took out the entire pile. That may have been the first time I can remember him doing that dive, was actually after a Shawn Michaels Undertaker match. So I guess it was appropriate to see him do it again here. He does the dive, and the spot was supposed to be Shawn pulling the ref. I'm sorry, not the ref. Pulling the cameraman, who was a plant. The cameraman was played by, I don't think it was Cliff Compton. It was Sim Snuka. I think it was Snuka's son, Domino. They had him dressed up as a cameraman. And, you know, to this day, it's hard to really lay blame. You know, is it all Snuka's fault? Or, you know, maybe. I'm sure he took most of the heat for it. I think Undertaker bears some of the blame, too. I think everybody does. But the point was that Shawn was supposed to pull him in the way, and Undertaker would land on him, and he would help break Undertaker's fall and protect him. Well, he landed a little in front of the cameraman. Now, he took out Snuka. If you go back and watch it, I mean, he fucking took this, he wiped this guy out. But unfortunately, Undertaker landed right on his head. And I'm not even there. I'm watching it at home, and I'm thinking, this guy's fucking paralyzed. I mean, it was awful. It was awful to watch. I mean, anybody doing a move like that and landing the way he landed would be scary. But this is a fucking 300-pound, almost 7-foot-tall, older guy. Even then, Undertaker was, you know, he was getting up there in years. And he's 6'10", 300 pounds, all that weight coming down on his neck. It was very, very scary. One of the scarier things you've ever seen at a WrestleMania before. Aside from that one year when they had the John Cena entrance with all the John Cena clones, that was pretty fucking scary. So, yeah, I'm watching this thinking, this guy's not going to get up. This is terrible. I mean, obviously I'm concerned about The Undertaker, but selfishly I'm also like, shit, I've waited so many years for this goddamn match. It can't end like this. So somehow The Undertaker survived and was able to move his extremities, and he eventually climbed back in, and it was this big dramatic thing. And I don't know if he was concussed. He had to be concussed. I mean, I don't see how he couldn't be. I mean, I remember reading after the match, like later that night, they had the annual WrestleMania party back at the hotel. Apparently, Undertaker was there. He was in a great mood because he knew he had this classic match, and he was, you know, like not the life of the party, but he was okay. But he somehow got back in and proceeded to do the rest of the match. They did this big dramatic choke slam spot. Shawn was going for the super kick. Undertaker caught him. Big choke slam, near fall. Now, some people will criticize this match for, well, they just did a bunch of moves and kicked out of a bunch of moves. It's no different than a John Cena match today. Even the John Cena matches today are not great. He's just kicking out of everybody's move. And that's true. But that doesn't mean it's not a great match. So I didn't mind the fact that these guys were kicking out left and right because it added to the drama of the match. You didn't know who was going to win. I mean, I didn't honestly think that Shawn was breaking the streak, but that was part of the allure of the match also. Is Shawn Michaels going to be the one to break the streak? There were some people who thought maybe he would. I wasn't one of those people, but it added to the drama of the match. My favorite spot from the entire match was the first tombstone. So what happened was, you had both guys. Shawn comes running at the Undertaker. Undertaker sidesteps him. Shawn goes over the top rope. He's skinning the cat. And as he reaches his legs up to pull the Undertaker out of the ring, we've seen him do it a million times before, Undertaker had a really slick counter where he turned it into a tombstone. I thought that was pretty cool. He drops Shawn on his head. Now, by this point, Undertaker nearly killed himself. The match has been going on for a while. I don't know how many minutes, 15, 20 minutes by that point. You could believe that that would be the finish, and Shawn kicks out. Now, in future WrestleMania matches, people were kicking out of the tombstone every year. Shawn did it the following year. Triple H did it. Punk did it. I think Punk did it. So after a while, it became like, okay, everybody kicks out of that first tombstone. But at that point, I don't know that very many people had kicked out of the tombstone before. So it was a genuine shock when Shawn kicked out, and that great camera shot of The Undertaker's face, like he shat his pants or something. It's just that great close-up shot. And the match goes on from there. And they're just slugging it out back and forth and throwing, you know, haymakers at each other. And Undertaker just gives him a boot right to the face. Shawn had a great super kick spot. He super kicked him right in the face and went for the cover. Actually, you know what? This was one of my favorite moments of the entire match. And it was nothing that they did. It was the reaction of the fans in the front row. So Shawn gives him that last super kick of the match. And Undertaker is down, and Shawn does the slow crawl over. And Undertaker, of course, kicks out at 2 3/4. And there's a guy in the front row. He's an older guy. He was a bald guy, I think, with a goatee, if I remember. I haven't watched the match in a couple of years. This guy, he jumped up, he pumped his fist. Like, he was so happy. Everybody was. Everybody reacted perfectly. Everybody was just hanging on to every fucking move these guys were doing, no matter how much you just knew. There's no way that Shawn Michaels is going to be the one to break the streak. They're not going to waste that on him. Of course Undertaker's going to win. He wins every year. Didn't matter. This is a match that had you on the edge of your seat, buying into the near falls by the end of the match. And I didn't think it was possible to do that, because every Undertaker match to me was so predictable. So they got me. And that's one of the things I loved about this match. I was already looking forward to it because I was waiting for it for so long, but they got me. They actually, for that spot, that one spot, they had me convinced, holy shit, this might be the end. And then he kicked out and I said, God damn it, they got me. And so after that, you know, Shawn did the moonsault and Undertaker caught him, gave him the second tombstone, got the pin. It was just such a great match. So much fun to watch. And it's a match that I can go back and watch on repeat. You know, there's some matches you can watch them once and then you go back. It's like, oh, I don't really want to sit through this again. It's not repeat worthy. This is a match I can go back and watch again. Like the 92 Rumble. Most matches I'm talking about in this countdown are matches that I would not mind going back and watching again at any moment if I have some time free. I can go back and watch these over and over again. And this is one of those matches. The match at WrestleMania 26 was very good, but I don't think it was as good as the WrestleMania 25 match. It's hard for me to say, was this their best match or was the Hell in a Cell their best match? I would tend to lean towards this one. No gimmicks, no interference, just straight up two guys who at that point were, you know, I mean, they were already main eventers back in 97, but by 2009, these guys were on another level. I mean, these were, you know, Hall of Famers, legends that weren't necessarily in their prime anymore. Shawn wasn't necessarily in his prime, although he was still great. Undertaker's a weird one, because Undertaker had such horrible, god-awful matches in the early part of his career in WWE, and a lot of that had to do with who he was working with. It's hard to get a, you know, come on. At the time, all the guy did was no-sell things and choke people. That was his whole gimmick. Didn't matter what you did to him, he would no-sell it, and he would fucking choke you. Until the referee said, hey, break, and he would break, and he would choke you again. So between the gimmick and the people he was working with, like Giant Gonzalez, and who was the other guy? He worked a Raw match. Like Damian Demento, and Kamala, and King Kong Bundy, all those kind of guys. You weren't going to get a fucking five-star classic out of The Undertaker. But as he got older, and as his career progressed, and he started working with better people, it wasn't like he would bring down the match. Oh, he's just a big guy. He's old. He can barely move. He was hanging in there with him and having some of the best matches of his career. The WrestleMania matches that he had with Orton and with Batista, which overachieved, and with Edge and with Michaels and with Triple H and with CM Punk. You know, this guy went out there, was having the best matches of his career in the twilight of his career. How is this possible? This guy is a freak of nature. This shouldn't be happening. So there were a lot of things that went into making this match as special as it was. The match itself was outstanding. The build-up to it was great, even though, again, I think they missed out on something by not going with the whole story of what happened that led to Shawn being out of the business for 4.5 years, since you could trace it directly back to this guy. It just seemed like an obvious story to me. They still knocked it out of the park. And just these two guys, again, later on in their career, going out and putting that kind of performance on and telling a story and getting at least some people to buy into the fact that, hey, Shawn might actually win this fucking thing. It was just, I can't say enough good things about it. I think before that match, if you would have asked me what was my favorite all-time WrestleMania match, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, I was a mark for Hogan Warrior, which was another match, kind of like Undertaker Batista, I think was a lot better than people thought it would be going in. I'm a big fan of Bret Hart and Roddy Piper, obviously a big fan of Bret vs. Owen and the Shawn Razor Ladder match. I probably would have went with the Bret Austin match at WrestleMania 13, but once I saw this match, I said I didn't think it was possible. It's very difficult for me to find a match now that I would say this is my new favorite. And I don't know why that is, because I think the wrestling in WWE, the actual wrestling in WWE now, may be as good as it's ever been. If you like match to match in terms of the quality, it's certainly as good as any of the other great matches. But there's, you know, it's nostalgia. So you look back and you're like, well, this match can never be topped. And so in your mind, you just cannot allow these new matches. You can't allow yourself to admit that they're actually better than something you saw 20, 25 years ago. I still say the 1992 Royal Rumble is my favorite and is the best, but I mean it. There has not been a Rumble match since that has been better than that one. But there are people who might say something like that, and you know, they're just saying it because they can't let go of, you know, what used to be their favorite match. This was very easy for me. Once I watched this match, I knew right away. I said, this is my new favorite. So head on over to the network. It's up there right now. WrestleMania 25, Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker. That is match number 3 here on our countdown. Next week, we'll do match number 4 as we count down 8 of my favorite WWE matches of all time, building to the 8-year anniversary podcast on November 8th. Keep emailing me, even though I'm still going through all my emails, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Don't forget, we have a store, I didn't mention this earlier, on Pro Wrestling Tees. I got my own fucking URL wrong. It's prowrestlingtees.com/solemnmonstersoundsoff. It's the full name of the podcast. We have over 20 shirts. They ship all over the world up to a size 5XL. And you can follow me on Twitter as well. @solemnmonster is my handle. We have Sound Off Extra videos up on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thesolemnmonster. You can subscribe to that there. And one last shout-out for our friend Joey Numbers. He's going to be on the Race Wars podcast on OP Radio this Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern time. I'm sure he'll be very funny, as he usually is, so check him out on there. And we'll be back next weekend for episode 404. So until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. And for those of you that have already sent birthday wishes, I appreciate it. And we'll see you right back here again for more Sound Off next weekend. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemnmonster sounds off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always were. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
Solemnmonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solemnmonster sounds off. Available at thesolemnmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemnmonster sound off.